I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Happy New Year. It is 2018, and this is going to be your best year yet. I can feel it. I know it. And it's also the year that you're going to experience the most growth. That's why I'm so excited about today's episode. It's with David Baker, who wrote possibly my favorite book of the year in 2017. I read 57 books, and this was definitely one of my favorite books. The reason why I'm excited that this episode is coming out at the beginning of the year in 2018 is because it's going to show you just what you need to work on in order to map out your thought leadership and also your expertise. So make sure you check it out. People have been asking me about Thought Leader Academy. Yes, that is still going on. It closes on the 14th of January. So if you still want to enroll, if you still want to be part of the program, the 3-month coaching program that basically gives you a step-by-step approach on what you need to do in order to be a thought leader in your industry, what you need to do in order to be a speaker, and what you need to do in order to attract the right press so that you can leverage that to build a movement, you can still enroll. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. But without further ado, make sure you get David Baker's book, but also listen to the episode. One of the most fascinating individuals I've interviewed in the past 3-4 years I've been doing this. So check it out.
In a world where very few people embrace their global identity and seek to understand their neighbors, cross-cultural expert Tayo Roxon is on a mission to bridge this divide. Each week, he'll open your mind with insights from some of the global minds in the world. Get ready, take some notes, and learn how to be the best you that you can be.
Welcome everybody to another episode of As Told by Nomads. I am so excited to have today's guest on the show. I have been reading his book like a madman. I really, really love this book. It is something that I think everyone needs to read. It's called The Business of Expertise. And David grew up with a tribe of Mayan Indians in a remote village in the highlands of Guatemala. He's an author, speaker, advisor, and he's someone that really helps entrepreneurial experts position themselves effectively. This is his fifth book. He's a helicopter and airline pilot, an avid photographer, and taught high performers motorcycle riding. So there's definitely nothing that he doesn't have a passion in. And he's based in Nashville. He's visited and worked all over the world. And today we're going to learn about his multicultural background, but also why he believes that experts and consultants today make a lot of mistakes in order for them to be positioned as the best entrepreneurs that they can be. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I need to borrow some of your energy. I feel like I'm drinking coffee just listening to you.
It's so funny. People say that to me all the time, but I don't drink coffee.
Can you imagine if you did? The world would be in big trouble.
I don't drink coffee or drink alcohol. And people always tell me that because they're like, I don't know how you wake up with that energy. Why are you so loud? And they're like, how many cups of coffee do you drink? And I'm like, I didn't drink any coffee. And they're like,
oh, that's great. No, I appreciate it. I appreciate the engagement, especially. And thank you for the kind introduction. I'll try to live up to it.
The funny thing is you say you try to live up to it, but you've already lived up to it. You know, I mean, written this fifth book, and you did live in Guatemala, and now you are married. So it's
yeah.
So let's start with your background. Not everyone gets to grow up with a tribe of Mayan Indians, especially you wouldn't say a white American in, you know, in the highlands of Guatemala. So what took you there?
Yeah, no kidding. I am a white American, and I was the only there. I didn't have any friends who looked like me. But you know what? It never struck me as odd. In fact, I never really made much of an issue of my background until I was maybe in my 30s, because it just seemed kind of normal to me. And I think that's the way a lot of people who live in varied cultures, remote cultures, feel. It's like, this is the real world. It's you folks that are sort of strange. It's and it was very different. So when I was 4 or 5, I can't remember what age, we moved from the Detroit area down to Costa Rica. My parents needed to learn Spanish. That was the trade language, that not the language we spoke mostly, but the trade language. And so I was dropped into a Spanish kindergarten. I didn't know any Spanish, but it wasn't traumatic at all. I learned Spanish very quickly, as any young child does. We lived there for a year, and then we moved to Guatemala, where I lived for 13 years with a tribe of Mayan Indians, as you said. It was very remote. There were no plumbing, no electricity. The roads were, that's kind of generous to call them roads. It took 6 hours to go 60 miles on this path, and very few stores. So that's just how we lived, you know. I took correspondence courses. Mom didn't really teach me. It was more just self-paced. And I would get through a year's worth in about 2 or 3 months, which was great. And then I would just explore the country. I rode a motorcycle, didn't have a driver's license. I just remembered I used a fishing license that was in English that I got one visit in the U.S. and they couldn't read it. So I'd show it to them and they were like, well, it looks really official. It's got stamps on it. It must be a driver's license from another country. So that's how I kind of got around the country on a motorcycle. And my parents were, I don't know if they were crazy or if they just really believed in freedom, but they just let me wander. I didn't even have that much money. I'd just stop and eat at people's homes or stay with other people that I knew. And it was a great life. It almost seems otherworldly. I almost have to pinch myself because it seems like a life that would have happened 300 or 400 years ago, not just 20 or 30 years ago.
Wow. I hear you. I mean, it does sound like it, but I have two immediate questions then. What did your parents do that took you there, and what did you learn about yourself while growing up there?
Yeah, so my parents were medical missionaries. So Dad did dental work and Mom did nursing work, and they also did literacy work. They were with a Protestant mission. I'm not too proud of some of the work that they did, like exporting a white man's religion. Honestly, I feel quite uncomfortable with that part of it. But the rest of what they were doing, I'm still really proud of. So that answers that question. And in terms of what I learned about myself, it shaped my personality. I'm a loner. I'm not that fantastic with people. It's difficult for me. I have to work hard at it. I am very independent. So those are strengths. Those are my strengths. I wanted to ask you about this actually. Those are my strengths, but when they're overused, they are my biggest weaknesses as well. And it's something that I've been seeing in myself and other people as well, that our biggest strengths, when overused, are also our biggest weaknesses. So yeah. Like you, I've noticed that you sign off podcasts about how you can make a unique contribution to the world. And I so believe that, but it's also like, if we make too unique of a contribution to the world, or if we overuse it without bringing a little bit of balance, I think we can harm the world around us. At least that's what I found for myself, that my greatest strengths can be my greatest weaknesses as well.
Well, I mean, and I think that's what a lot of us, I like to describe myself as a walking contradiction, and believe it or not, you said I was very energetic. I've always been energetic from kid till now, but I, at one point in my life when I kept moving, I turned into this introvert because I was I was afraid of my uniqueness. I was. All I wanted to do as a kid was stand out. I mean, I say this all the time, you know, and when I was 10, I was a skinny Nigerian kid with a Nigerian accent in a French speaking country in an American international school going through puberty. And so I just wanted to be able to have friends and to have girls like me because I was, you know, going through puberty, and I wanted to be able to ask someone out to a dance and have her not tear up the card, which did happen to me. She tore up the card.
You're still stinging from that, I can tell.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. It's funny, we're Facebook friends now, and she has no idea that she did that. And she's and I'm like, oh, I'm never going to out her. But because she's so nice and she's high, she looks very happy. But I just remember that traumatizing experience where she just tore a card that I created for her on Valentine's Day. But it's all good.
So how did you learn to be like, or where did the energy come from? Like how, so you when you were an introvert or acting like an introvert, how did the energy change? Were you still very energetic, and how did that manifest itself?
I think the energy was transformed into me trying to be a class clown, you know. A lot of times and I'm sarcastic now, but a lot of times when I was trying to find a way to fit in, I thought, well, I use sports. I play a lot of sports, and sports is one way. And the other way was I thought, well, if I was funny, maybe I could mask away a lot of things and people would, you know, like me for jokes. But I honestly don't know. I mean, I was born this way. I'm the oldest of three boys, and I've always just had a zest for life. You know, I was a kid that was watching Oprah Winfrey and Nelson Mandela, and I was like, I want to be that person. And I don't know.
Right.
It just happened that way. So. Yeah. But I think the reason why I really love your book as we get into this is that when you talk about, there's a chapter, we'll get to that later, where you ask people to ask other people what their unique contributions are to the world and what that is. And a lot of what my things that I've done that before is people always say, well, you help connect people and people that never would have been friends in the same place. And I think it obviously comes from my background when I moved in different places. I just was able to see different things. But my energy, I found, which can be a weakness if I'm not harnessed in the right way, has also inspired people to just feel like just normally happy. Like, oh, this guy's cheery randomly.
Right.
I'm just going to smile back.
And the enthusiasm, like you've already connected me because I was listening to your podcast. And I was really struck by one episode in particular, and you offered to connect me to that person. And it is almost like you're like one of these matchmakers, but it's driven by, I can tell this by listening to you. I feel like I'm interviewing you, which is sort of flipping this around, but it feels like your perspective is to help people, and that the money through commerce will come and you're not worried about it, which is a really unique perspective. And to me, that's what drives my content marketing. It's what drives the book. Or the books, plural. It's this notion of helping people. And I just know that enough people will hire me and I don't have to work at it. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to, it's not at the top of my mind. If my perspective is to think really clearly and try to help people, the rest of it's going to happen.
Absolutely. And you're so spot on with that perspective is because, you know, I'm, as you said, I'm 20 years old, but when you come from a Nigerian culture, you're the oldest of three boys, you're not just representing your family, you're representing your extended family. And they send you to a foreign country, you're supposed to be a lawyer, engineer, or doctor. And I had a dream when I was 10 to sort of change the world by exposing people to different perspectives. But then I came to America, 85 job rejections. Then I gave up and did, you know, a typical job that wasn't suited to my skills. And then 2 years of that was... was misery. And then, you know, it wasn't until near-death experience I decided to quit the job that gave me a visa in this country and I freaked my parents out. And then I moved to New York City without any money and just a dream. And, you know, to satisfy my parents, I took an MBA. So like, okay, your son is at least he's getting an education. So I got the education there. But then it was what you said. I just felt like it was no more. I was just driven. I felt like I had suppressed all that desire to help so much and use my gifts. And, you know, in the process of getting fired twice, being broke, owing the IRS money, owing, you know, several back pay of rent, I honed the expertise and turned it into a platform. And then I just shed away worry, even though I should have been worried many times. But that's one of the reasons I love your book, though, because in your book you talk about how to inspire people to narrow their focus with greater courage. And that's what I try to learn about myself. And then you urge them to articulate more with concise points of view, and then you steer them to a greater clarity about who they are as professionals. So tell me why you decided to write this book, The Business of Expertise.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because the book I decided to write ended up not being the book I actually wrote. So I had done so much, my own processes, I don't know how typical it is, but I do tons of research and then I craft a very detailed outline. And that's the hard part for me. And then once I start fleshing out the outline, that's when it feels like I framed the house and I've hung all the drywall, and then I'm painting it. That's what writing feels like to me. I love that part of it. And I just go to our cabin and I write 2,000 to 4,000 words a day, 5-6 days in a row. I take the afternoons off to go hike and stuff, and it's wonderful. But as I was doing the writing part, so I'd finished the research, I'd finished the outline, this big sigh of relief because I'm finally in the writing stage that I love. I feel comfortable doing it. And I realize it's like, oh my God, it's like I'm writing another Wikipedia book. And it was passionless to me. The book I wrote before this was called Financial Management of a Marketing Firm. It's really changed a lot of people's businesses. It's been a really impactful book, but it wasn't passionate. The other one was a little bit passionate about managing people, but not all that much. And so I decided to just follow my passion on this book and see where it would lead. And I was so inspired by this notion of getting to know, and the know is spelled K-N-O-W there rather than N-O, getting to know. It's getting to that point in your life when you exchange this pursuit, this all-out pursuit of variety for a pursuit of a deeper competence, right? Where clients are willing and excited to pay you for turning the lights on in their lives, whatever that is, whatever your focus is. And the book became much shorter than it was going to be, 110,000, 120,000 word book. This one ended up being about 45,000, so much shorter. I decided to make it a small handbook looking thing. I decided to illustrate it, decided to print it in full color, and it just became like this manifesto, like a manifesto for expertise. Not a manifesto for consulting, because I'm really uncomfortable with a lot of those concepts, but a manifesto for expertise, like for people to change their world. There are lots of ways to change their world. I'm a particular advocate of changing your world through expertise, knowing what the hell you're – can I say hell on here? I don't know.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want. You can say whatever
you want. So knowing what the hell they're talking about, it's like – and once you've tasted both, I'm sure. You've tasted incompetence where you're making shit up. Mm-hmm. And then more recently in your life, you have tasted real competence. And that's because you decided, in one case, just one example, you decided to put yourself out there to risk failing again, doing a podcast and all that comes along with that, and learning how to interview people, how to tie all this stuff together. That's expertise. You decided to say no to 90 of the 100 things you were doing and focus on the 10 things. And maybe when you're 38 and 48 and 58, the list will be even smaller. You know, that's the concept of expertise. It's just deciding to know what the hell you're talking about. And I am passionate about that.
No, and you are absolutely right. This is so funny. This is one of those rare interviews where I get to share a lot of it myself, and a lot of the guests sometimes want to know what was the process with you. So, you know, on the outside, you know, I'm foreigner with an MBA, has a degree in business, has a MBA in marketing and communications. I am doing communications now, but I wouldn't say anything that I learned is what I'm applying. But at the same time, I'm glad I went through that process because, you know, there's certain things you learn from school, discipline, networking, and all that. But everything that I decided to do in my career is what you said. You know, once I decided to shed away other people's perceptions of what success was for me and just embrace failure more, you know, when I started the podcast, it was 2014.
And I just decided to really hone in a lot of things that were already raw in me. And yeah. When we talk about this, I started to look for patterns. You know, it was...
Right, yes, patterns.
Yeah. I'm telling you, man, this is one of my favorite books of the year because I kept writing and checking things up. But it was patterns, and I want your perspective, pattern matching. But what happened, though, where this really blew up was I could never have predicted that we would have, you know, Trump as president, we would have Brexit, right. We'll have all the stuff that goes on in the world. And people that listened to my content and observed me for a while, all of a sudden started to demand more of my expertise for some reason. I started to get more emails from people randomly or people that I pitched to before years.
Right.
Now started to say yes, because it immediately became relevant. And I'm always saying to myself, I wonder what would have happened if I decided to give up during those times when I wasn't getting traction. And it's right. Just crazy with the timing and all that, because anyone that knows me, I'm always a self-deprecating person, but at some level I had to accept that I was good at something and just put it out there in the world and say, I am someone that can help connect people across cultures. And people are like, well, we need someone with a skill in cultural competency and how that can tie into leadership. And because of the body of work that I'd put that I maybe sometimes didn't think mattered, all of a sudden it matters that you have over 300 episodes and you've spoken over 200 times. And, you know, all these things now start to add up. And so I hope as you hear David talking with pattern matching and finding your role in the world and anyone listening here, that you shouldn't give up honing your skills because you never know when it becomes relevant.
Absolutely. And what you just described to me is something I talk about in the book, is that I can sometimes, so if I'm working with a client who is kind of where maybe you were 4 years ago or 5 years ago, I'll often believe in them more than they believe in themselves. They have enough belief that they keep forging ahead, but I look at the quality of their thinking and their discipline, and I say, oh my God, it's like you should be making so much more money. You're really much better than you think. But what I say doesn't matter. What matters is the marketplace acceptance.
Yes.
And you just described marketplace acceptance in your own way, and that's exactly right. The marketplace started to affirm what you had some suspicions about, and that gave you the confidence to raise your game, right? And to fully embrace the stage that you're playing on. That's a beautiful process.
Yeah, thank you so much. And much like you with the Mayan experience, I spent the first 9 years of my life in a military dictatorship, but I didn't think anything of it until recently. Yeah. I was like, military dictatorship, you know, a lot of people died and unfortunately, but I was going back to connect the dots and I was like, wow, that did shape my life, because I remember I used to ask my dad questions. Why is it that we can't express our opinions? Why is it that we live in a country of over 250 ethnic groups and this is happening? And it was very curious, but looking back, it obviously tapped into my curiosity, because that's how I became fascinated with Nelson Mandela. And I had taken that for granted. I was like, Mandela's free in a country from apartheid, and I desperately wanted to help free our country from that. And if we just take things for granted, and it was when I started to notice the patterns with Oprah, communication, Nelson Mandela, making an impact and bringing people from different backgrounds together. That's essentially what I've married today with media and doing that. So can you explain why pattern matching is so important?
Yes, and I think that if I remember, that's really how I start the book out, because I don't go to see movies. I love movies actually, but it's hard for me to sit still that long. And I don't know, I didn't grow up with them. The same reason I don't do ice skating, because I didn't have any ice skating. I don't know how to snow ski, you know, just things I didn't grow up with. And so I don't go very often. I go to a movie every 4 or 5 years. And one of the most impactful movies I ever went to, of course, I haven't gone to many, right? I did the first movie I went to. I was 22 years old. That says something. But I was a Beautiful Mind. I saw A Beautiful Mind. Yeah. And my wife and I were sitting in the front row. And it's actually hard for me to talk about this without being emotional about it, because I thought that I saw myself and John in that movie, and like having unusual intelligence, which doesn't matter, frankly, but different people skills, as in like measured against the average person, sort of deficient people skills. But seeing how he changed the course of history, largely because he noticed patterns. And in fact, a columnist with the New York Times told me in an email recently that I should have named this book, and the book hasn't been mentioned in the Times. He was just emailing me, and he said, you should have called this The Monetization of Pattern Matching. And I thought, that's really probably true, because I, from a photographer standpoint, I'm fascinated by the patterns I see in nature as well as just architecture and so on. And then when you look at the foundation of intelligence, it's built on this premise of pattern matching. That's why kids can notice patterns even before they can read and write. And we can measure a child's intelligence level by their ability to match patterns. And in my own experience, fast forwarding a couple of decades, my own experience in consulting was that it was actually 4 years into my consulting practice before I started to look at it through the perspective of pattern matching. I was sitting there one day getting ready to make a presentation to the client after spending 2 days at the firm, and I recognized that I was saying some of the same things that I had said the week before with a different firm and the week before with a different firm and so on. And it hit me like, oh my goodness, I've got to stop here. I've got to stop, and I've got to start paying very different kinds of attention to pattern matching, because patterns are what enable us to solve problems quicker and more reliably. And so the business of expertise is really about focusing your practice so that you put yourself in front of similar situations, which then allows you to see patterns. It's that 3 ABC step process. All right, so if we take the ABC step process and we contrast that with the way a more typical expert might work, we have an expert who's trying to be an expert in too many areas, right? And so everything they do looks different from what they did before. It's a really exciting practice. It's what draws people into an unpositioned firm because there's so much variety. Yeah. But it's not really earning your keep. It's not really that's that process that happens slowly over time. You trade your strong desire for variety for a deeper desire for expertise so that you're really earning the money for clients.
Right. No, I love that. And one of the things you talk about in the book, I'm looking through my notes here, and there's a section where you talk about confidence, opportunity, and capacity.
Right? Right.
So a lot of people who are, you know, seen as experts, there's those three things that deflate or inflate based on people's perceptions of them. Why do you feel like confidence is something that every consultant needs to actually work on? And how do you feel like that aligns with opportunity and capacity?
Yeah, so the confidence comes, and we talked about this a few minutes ago a little bit, talking about how if I go into a firm, or like if you're going to work with a new client and you believe in their abilities more than they do, and I find that quite frequently is the case. And so one option would be for me to kind of reach down inside them and pull up that confidence level. And now all of a sudden, boom, they're a different person and they're charging more appropriate fees and they're worming their way deeper into clients' lives because of that confidence. But it doesn't work that way. Confidence usually comes from it's the kind of thing that your mommy and your daddy did for you. Even against all the evidence, they believed in you, right? My parents were sort of that way. Your parents were too, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. So I don't have access to reaching in and pulling up the confidence. So what I can do is I give them a tighter positioning, which makes lead generation easier. Because with the right positioning, lead generation is easier because now I know where to find my prospects. I know what to say to them. I know what services they're frequently going to want. I know what people I'll need in order to fulfill those promises and so on. So I give them more opportunities, and then the marketplace acceptance comes, which is what something you and I talked about earlier. Yeah. So that's the confidence side. Now, and I think that's true around the world. This next one I think is different in developed cultures versus developing cultures, in the sense that in the U.S. in particular, we are so in love with the idea of opportunity that we are willing to shed competence in order to chase opportunity. This is the land of opportunity, and it's almost wrong we feel like it's almost unethical to leave opportunity on the table. And so we do all kinds of really crazy, stupid things to chase opportunity. We go into debt when there were are other options for us, or we water down our focus because we love where this might lead us, right?
Yeah.
Now, the rest of the world doesn't view opportunity that way. It's a much more mature, enlightened view of opportunity. And what happens then is that we are constantly we're chasing this opportunity in developed cultures, and then we got to hire people to meet the opportunities that come our way, even though they're not all that profitable sometimes, they're just exciting. And we end up with a firm that's the size that the marketplace has determined it wants us to be, rather than the size firm we really should be based on our desire to manage people, to take financial risk, and all of those things. So what's the answer? What's the relationship between opportunity, capacity, and confidence, and particularly between capacity and opportunity? I think the size of your firm, whether you're a one-man shop like me or you're a...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
1,000-person firm. The relative size is you should always be a smaller firm than your opportunity, because that preserves this gap between opportunity and capacity. It preserves that ability for you to say no. Without the ability to say no, then you just feel duty-bound to take everything that comes your way, because you're just feeding this machine that you've created that's hungry, and it's going to eat you up. It's chasing you all the time. And if you don't keep throwing pieces of food behind you, it'll catch up and eat you. That's where we get into trouble. Wow. That's the biggest driver of compromise in business, is panic about what's going to happen if we don't compromise.
That's amazing. We're talking to David C. Baker, the author of one of my favorite books of the year so far, and I've read over 30, The Business of Expertise. Now, you just heard him talk about, you know, confidence and competency there. I want to hone in on this point, though. So a lot of listeners out there, a lot of you listening right now might have a skill. You might want to build a business around your expertise. You might want to build a business around, you might want to build, I don't know, a team around your expertise. But listen to this part. This is a part that I was reading on the bed and I almost fell off. He says, the idea that you should follow your heart and that success will follow you is a fool's errand. We could rewrite it though. Follow your heart, but do some research and planning first. Then save up some money so that you have a cushion without a compromise, without having to compromise. Fake it a little at first, we all do, but get smarter every day. Build a business that delivers the value that others enjoy paying you for. Enjoy your work and be disciplined about the parts you don't. Ensure a profitable enterprise to fund your excessive habits. Follow your heart, but follow your brain too. Explain, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I hope your bed isn't too far off the ground and you didn't hurt yourself when you fell off.
Hey, you know, they told me I was Kryptonian. Me and Superman are cousins, so I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think something that's crept into our culture nowadays, for developed cultures, is this notion that we somehow have the right to enjoy our work. And like it's a basic human right. And I really understand that concept. And as it turns out, I love my work. So I want to clarify too that there's nothing to be gained by hating your work. That's really silly thinking. To whatever degree we can enjoy our work, that's fantastic. There's no disadvantage to enjoying your work. The disadvantage comes in demanding that we enjoy our work. And my thinking on this really does come back to my childhood. So, and you'll relate to this growing up in Nigeria. So a villager in Nigeria would get up and they'd have the same breakfast every day, and they'd get up at whenever the sun appeared, right? Because there wasn't electricity, and they'd go out and they'd work in the fields. Now, did they go out and work in the fields because they were just so excited about that and they couldn't wait to do it? And the night before, they're just sitting around the fire talking with friends about how they couldn't wait to get out in the fields again. No, they did it because that's what they needed to do to live. Now, fast forward a couple of millennia here, or a couple of centuries anyway, and is it like there's no virtue, I get, again, in not enjoying your work? But if we say that everybody has a right to love their work, what we're doing is we're disenfranchising 90% of the freaking planet. And I think that's wrong. So to whatever degree we can enjoy our work, that's fantastic. But if we use that as like the signaling call, like that's the primary criteria, I must enjoy my work. And it shows up in these cultural phrases like follow your heart and success will follow. That's just bullshit. There's a lot of people who are following their hearts who are starving. Now, so there's a mix, right? So we don't want to say, oh, no, don't follow your heart. That'd be stupid advice. But we want to follow your heart with some smarts too. So that's kind of why I ended that phrase, trying not to be too harsh by saying follow your heart, but mix in a little bit of brain too. You're self-aware. Like, I'm not worried. If you decided to follow your heart, I wouldn't be worried about it. Okay, but there's somebody in your family, and I don't know your family, so I can say this. You wouldn't dare agree with me here, but there's somebody in your family that comes together at family reunions, and every time they come together, they've got a new pursuit. They're following their heart, and they never settle down and accomplish anything in the world. They're always following their heart, jumping from one thing to the next. Those are the people that I'm talking to, not the smart people that are using their head and their heart at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and I find that comes from a lack of self-awareness. It actually comes from not understanding the why of what your expertise is. And you talk about entrepreneur expertise. So how do you find the why for your entrepreneur expertise? I love what you said in the book, but I want you to explain those four concepts.
Yeah. So part of the why, are you talking about like money and impact and so on?
We'll talk about that too, but the values, purpose, mission.
And vision. Yeah. So I'm the equivalent of a B corporation in that I've made a commitment. And in Tennessee, I was the first service firm that applied for that a couple of years ago. And it means that I don't just exist for profit. But it doesn't mean that I have to make any compromises around profit either. It just means that I have a very specific mission in the world, and that's to help people. And it's okay to make money in the process. But why does your organization exist? Do you read a lot of books? I imagine you've read, you know, the seminal book about Simon Sinek's book about why and purpose and so on. I think that's a fantastic book. And it's amazing to me that it took that long. It took, you know, in the late 1900s for somebody to write a book that's that good about mission and purpose. And I so believe that, right? It's balance is the key. We can be a mission or purpose-driven firm, and we can also make money. And how do we tie all those things together? Maybe if we're going to rate them, that's a tougher exercise, but maybe we can bring balance in all of those areas, and then we can enjoy our work, right? Enjoying our work means it's not just about what I'm doing during the day. It's about the fact that maybe I'm not worried sick to death that I'm not going to make payroll next week. That's a part of enjoying your work. Or maybe it's part of enjoying your work is standing up on stage and not being afraid of a single question that somebody could ask because you know the material so well. Or maybe it's not being afraid of having a shallow perspective when a client is questioning you in a boardroom. It's like there's many ways to enjoy work, and I've tasted competence as so have so many other people, and I think competence is really great. It helps me enjoy my work. I don't mean, though, that I can't make money and that I can't enjoy what I do, but there's got to be room for competence in this story somewhere, too.
Yeah, yeah. No, that and why I love what you said there is because you really put it in almost this period. You know, this is a visual book as well. There's like this triangle, and then there's an upside-down triangle. You said start with the values, go to the purpose, right, and then your mission and your vision. Can you explain those four concepts so the listeners can just get a taste of what to expect in the book? What are the values to you? What is purpose to you? What is mission, and what is vision?
Yeah, so you do have to start in that order because – and I find those concepts really confusing, honestly. They're still a little confusing to me. I was trying to clarify them a little bit. Maybe it's because people use those phrases differently. And so, you know, you go into a typical corporation and they've got values and mission and purpose. And it's like, well, what's the difference between the two? Well, to me, so you start with values. And those are the things that would never change no matter what. No matter what your job was, no matter what your ownership position was, those are the values that never change, right? And then as you work down through these other things, they become more and more applicable to your particular job. So what are the values that I have personally? What are the values of our organization? What are we trying to accomplish as an organization? Like if we could wave a magic wand and we could say, like, this is David Land, and I'm king, and I get to make all the decisions. What would success look like? That's how you start to personalize this stuff. So it's really – I don't want people to get too hung up on those things because yeah, a lot of it can be belly button gazing where – and I also – I get nervous if I see plaques on the wall talking about it because there's an inverse relationship between it. Like, the more people talk about it, the less likely it's true. But there is room to reflect on this stuff personally, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, thank you for, you know, taking some moment to talk about that. Now, the other thing that you wrote this book for consultants, for people, specialists, for people who are trying to build an expertise, or rather, already have an expertise and maybe want to learn more.
Right.
Now, you say something in the book. You say what's even more ironic is that consultants and marketers who are supposed to understand positioning better than any professional services are the absolute worst at positioning themselves. This is something a lot of specialists in the world struggle with. How do I position myself? How do I figure out how to market myself when everybody else seems to do the same thing? Can
right,
you educate us on the importance of positioning and the mistakes that many businesses make?
Sure. So I think positioning is so important because it drives so many other decisions, like where we're going to find our clients, what we're going to do for them, what kind of people we're going to hire, the service offerings. I can't think of anything else that other than the mission, values, purpose, all that stuff. That's really the foundational. But once you've got that nailed, you've got to have positioning next. Without positioning, we don't know what we're doing and so on. So that's why it's so important. But why is it that so many really smart professionals, even the ones who do positioning for a living, can't nail this for themselves? Well, partly, and I think mainly, it's because they're inside the bottle and they can't see their own label. And there's an illustration in the book about that. So I can see, like, I could do a better job of positioning you than I could do a better job of positioning myself. You could do a better job of positioning me than you could yourself because you can see things from the outside. That's why one of the exercises is to ask other people what you're really good at, because then you can compare all these independent voices and get a more objective perspective. That's a part of it. Another part of it is the black and white, cold, hard sort of decision-making process. So as I'm out there in my day-to-day as a professional, I am drawn to opportunities. Yesterday, I was taking pictures at a wildlife preservation park, which has nothing to do with my business. I just wanted to do it. I get drawn off mission quite a bit, and I recognize that in myself. It makes it easier for me to beat other people by it if I see it in myself as well. But I can make more black and white recommendations for somebody else than I can for myself. I don't get pulled off mission. One of the things that I see people doing frequently is in their own positioning, and this is different than it used to be 20 years ago. In the past, positioning decisions required a lot of thought, because We are going to print some expensive stationery that says who we are, and we're not going to have PowerPoint. We're not going to have color printers to have a different face on our expertise every time we go pitch something. Nowadays, what people are doing instead is they buy an unpainted white step van, and they're driving down the street from their office to one prospect after another every day, and they stop short of the prospect's office a block away. They pull over. They go to the back of the van. They flip through the 20 different magnetic signs. They pick the one that most closely matches what this new prospect wants to see the expert as. They throw it on the side of the van, pull in, and then say, "We are your ex, fill in the blank expert." And then they take the sign off and they use a different sign the next time they go somewhere. That's what modern technology has allowed us to do. It's allowed us to be different people in each case, and it's really watered down positioning. What I'm screaming for people to do in this book is to paint the van. Don't use a white unpainted step van and change the message every time. Paint the van. This gives you the opportunity to dive deeper and to flesh out your expertise and to start earning your money. I feel like I'm yelling at you here.
No, hey, keep it. No, but the reason why I can hear that passion and the reason why you're saying that is because I imagine you see a lot of businesses, just like you said, you can see the vision maybe even better than they can. And you're like, wow, no, if only you did that, you did this. And I find, you know, you're talking a lot about deep expertise with broad context, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. So, it's not that I'm smarter. It's just that I'm not them. I'm outside them, right?
All right, right. So when you're talking about deep expertise with broad concept, you're really talking about this idea of being a balanced expert. So what does a balanced expert look like to you? Because there's horizontal positioning and then there's vertical positioning and, you know, all these things are great. But is there a way where we can mix all those things? And I guess the listener right now is confused. So maybe let's start off with what is your definition of deep expertise with broad concept and then broad context, and then we can talk about horizontal, vertical.
Yeah. So I am advocating very, very deep expertise. Okay. But if that deep expertise is unhinged from reality, like you can picture this really weird professor in the library all the time developing this very deep expertise, and the world is changing or crumbling around him or her, and it's like, that's not very useful to the world, right? So we have to balance those two things together. Now, when we try to balance them those two things within the enterprise, that's what really messes things up. So when people demand that they must enjoy their work, then they position their firm so that it touches on all the things they want to do. Instead of saying, no, this business is about making money. It's about delivering value to my clients. Now, I still want this deep expertise to be placed within a deeper context. Where does the deeper context come from? Because I think experts need to be very curious, and they need to understand, they need to be able to have an intelligent conversation with almost anybody in the world for at least an hour. That's sort of the test for me. You might run out of things to say after that, but you should be able to have an interesting conversation. You should interest somebody, anybody in the world, for at least an hour. Now, where does that come from? If you're focusing your deep expertise in the business, that comes from your life outside of work. And it shouldn't look anything like your life in work. I would keep a separation between the two. And your personal life should be so incredibly diverse, so incredibly interesting, that when your work life starts to get in the way of your personal life, it pisses you off because you want to get out to this exciting life. Now, personally, I find deep expertise to be very satisfying and interesting. But even if it wasn't, that's still my commitment to clients to be somebody that delivers value. But then I use the money I make and I use the time I have, because I limit how much I work, to have a very interesting life outside of work. Not only does that keep me interested in life as a whole, but it also keeps my expertise in context and not unhinged from reality. That's how those two concepts work together.
Nah, that's beautiful. And that's so true. And do you find that a lot of people who want to be experts, who claim to be experts, aren't doing themselves any service by, you know, almost forgetting to build on the competency level? Maybe they rest on their laurels because they've All right. No, and you know, I have that thought as well many times, but it was interesting seeing it in a book where you actually paint the picture of why it's important to always continue to hone your skills. A lot of people think if you get to a certain level, you can sort of just rest on your laurels. And the danger with that today is you also talk about the fact that there are many other options and someone can end up positioning themselves better than you and take away your market share. So I just want you to talk about then the importance of horizontal and vertical positioning in that context where, you know, deep expertise, yes, but then some people say horizontal and vertical. What are those two things and how do they work?
So to define them, vertical expertise is tied to a specific industry category. So it might be an SIC code or an NAICS code, more modern version of that. So we're talking about manufacturing or healthcare or finance or high tech or whatever. That's vertical expertise where you're tied to a particular industry. And then horizontal expertise is across many of those same SIC codes, but you're targeting a demographic, say the aging population or millennials or whatever it is, or it's a particular service offering. So you're doing one thing for many different industries. That's horizontal expertise. And understanding those two and the pros and cons of each of them is something that, you know, the book talks quite a bit about because it's important to understand that. Like, most younger experts are drawn to horizontal expertise because of the variety, but then because they're touching so many different industries and each engagement looks a little bit different. But what they struggle with is that it's so much harder to find your clients with a horizontal expertise. So they sometimes will have to fall back to a vertical expertise. So there are some nuances around that, and I haven't seen much written on the difference between vertical and horizontal, so that's why I decided to devote several chapters to it.
Yeah, no, and someone listening may say, well, David, I get what you say on horizontal. I get what you say on vertical. Isn't there a way to have both?
Well, there is, for sure, yeah. Now we're talking about a hyper focus firm. So let's say we are talking about a PR firm that does crisis communications. That's a horizontal expertise. And then let's say that they develop a particular vertical expertise, like for firms that are going through an M&A process. So now we have, I think of it as almost like a bullseye, right? So we're combining a horizontal and a vertical in this site. The horizontal is the crisis, and the vertical is firms going through an M&A process. So crisis for M&A, it's like, man, you can own that positioning because there probably aren't going to be more than 5 or 10 firms in the whole world that are really good at that. But the process of positioning, usually you aren't quite that ambitious. You usually take steps toward it, and what stops you on the path of moving from an undifferentiated positioning to a really tight one, like I just described, what stops you on that process is either running out of opportunity. It's like, oh, we're so tight that there aren't enough clients for us, or more likely, actually, we run out of courage, right? It's like, oh, I know that's a good idea, but I don't like it. I don't want to do it. So when you make a positioning decision, ideally it's 20 years, but more realistically, it's a 5-year decision. Then what happens after 5 years? Well, you're going to tighten it even more because you're a friend of mine, Blair Inns, who he's my podcast partner, and he's written a book that's really influential. It's called The Win Without Pitching Manifesto. And he talks about this concept that's always, it's always struck me as so real. It's like you decide from a positioning standpoint, you decide to walk into a room, you walk into a door, through a door into a room, and you don't know what's in that room yet. You just know that the next step in your professional life is to be focused, and that means being in that room. You don't know what other doors are leading from that room until you go into it. Once you get in the room, you see that, like, while that might have seemed confining to you before you crossed the threshold, once you get in here, you see all kinds of other amazing opportunities you had no idea even existed before you crossed that through that door into the room.
Yeah, wow. No, I've got to tell you, I can't recommend this book enough. You really have to dive into it. And, you know, we don't have enough time to go into all the concepts because each page is something that you can take notes on. I want to segue into a core element of who you are, right? So there's a particular chapter that resonated with me because that's why I do this podcast. I truly want to make a global impact. I want to build the next level of global leaders. Mm. You say something about people needing to know their role in the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, there's something I spent time with a lot of animals yesterday, and they're such fascinating, beautiful creatures. But I don't know that any of them is thinking about their impact on the world. It seems like that's something that separates us from the rest of the creatures out there. There are a lot of things, but that's one big one. It's like our hearts are crying to have an impact on our world. And frankly, more of us, including me, ought to think about the impact we can have on our spouse, on our children, on our friends. And then if we have any extra energy, we ought to think about the impact we can have on the world around us. But there's something in our hearts that cries out to have an impact. And whether, I mean, I hope people recognize this of me when I die. I hope people show up, you know, and talk about it. But even if they don't, I want the satisfaction that comes from changing lives in a small way every day. Like, all of us want a bigger platform than we have in some ways. Not all of us, but some of us do. You do. I do. On the other hand, maybe there's just so much opportunity right here. We don't need a bigger platform. We can, every day, if we do our job, if we follow expertise, if we have critical thinking skills, if we are disciplined, we are having an impact on our world. And that's the thing about, like, what's the difference between a published author and an unpublished author? It's discipline. It's just being a fool and writing a book. I want to have an impact on the world. That's why I write. I love it, as it turns out. And other people have different ways of doing that. Yours is through a podcast and then touching people individually and connecting them. It's like our world could be a very different place if people thought more about how they could change the world from whatever perspective, from whatever platform they have.
That's beautifully said. That's beautifully said. Thank you so much for saying that, David. I could see and feel the passion in you as you say that. And obviously, it's something that's deeply rooted in your core. I was just on your Instagram. I saw the animal pictures. He's a great photographer, by the way. David Baker on Instagram. But you then, before the show, we were talking about what your idea of is of global citizenship. The listeners here come from 150 countries. Why do you feel like in today's world, global citizenship is something that needs to be taken seriously?
Because we need a broader perspective. We can't be coming up with solutions that really just work for our culture and then impose them on other people in the world. There has to be more empathy. There has to be more understanding. We've sent a lot of young folks to visit other countries for 30 days, and I don't care whether they're there to just talk with people, to learn a language, to help build a school or a clinic, or it doesn't matter to me. They just need to be exposed. Now, increasingly, you can go to New York City or Chicago, and it feels like you're going to a third world country in a way, a developing country, because there's so much beautiful diversity in the people that are there. In fact, thousands of the Mayan Indians I grew up with all migrated en masse to LA because of the civil war that was occurring in the early 70s. So there's just something about, I don't know, to me it's sitting on a seawall in Havana and talking with somebody. It's talking with somebody in a cab in Taipei. It's just understanding that as humans, we look different, we're different heights, we come from different backgrounds, we have different motivations, but the world is growing closer together. I do understand some of the nationalist, some of the fears that drive nationalism, and I'm against almost all of it, but the world is full of very interesting people, and it feels to me like global citizens are ones who do not think that their perspective is automatically right. They have a point of view, but they always hold it with a certain amount of humility, eager to listen to other people and see if they need to adjust that. It's the opposite of being sort of in your own bubble on Facebook, for instance.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to David Baker, who wrote a book that I consider one of my favorites this year, The Business of Expertise, and it's all about how entrepreneurial experts can convert their insights into impact and wealth. Where can they find the book, sir?
They can buy it at expertise.is, or Amazon, of course, carries it. And if anybody just is struggling with the funds to pay for one, just let me know and I'll certainly send it to them. It's not about the money, but they can get it on Amazon or our site, expertise.is.
No, this is essential. And you know, Daniel Pink, who is one of the great entrepreneurs, described this book as essential reading for entrepreneurs in any field. I'll certainly second that. And I think that you all should really get yourself some, depending on when this episode comes out, I'm hoping it comes out before Christmas, get yourself at least a New Year's gift by listening to this podcast, one, but also getting the book. I think that would be the most important thing. I always ask my guests this question, and it is the mission statement. It's my the reason why I do what I do, and I believe that we all can use our differences to make a difference. So how do you, David, use your difference to make a difference?
I think for me, it's having the courage to surface things in conversations that pretty much everybody is sensing, but nobody has the courage to say, and doing it in a kind, authentic way. That's probably at the core of what I do as an advisor. Great question.
And that's a great answer. So thank you. This has been one of my favorite interviews just because it was, I like to have conversational interviews, but this was more conversation than normal because, you know, you were interviewing me as well. And I love that. That was great. And there was just sheer curiosity on both ends. So I want to thank you for being as engaged as you are in this and just writing this book. I know I'm going to be following your work from now on, just because I love what you're doing. I think what you're doing is actually creating leaders. And I'm really, really excited to see
you. Thank you for having me as a guest. I really appreciate it. Very kind. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is mine. And ladies and gentlemen, till next time, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.